Welcome to the Health and Human Services Finance Committee. We do have a quorum. We have a motion to approve the minutes from January 11, 2017. Representative Albright moves the minutes from January 11, 2017. Any additions, corrections, subtractions? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Today we have Department of Human Services, and we have Commissioner Piper and Mr. Greenman are going to be presenting. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and proceed in any way you'd like. It's okay. Members can ask questions during your presentation if that's okay. If not, we can put them off until the end.
That's great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Emily Piper. I'm Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I really appreciate the opportunity to present to you today and answer any questions you might have. Representative Dean has asked us to provide an orientation to the department and how we do our work, including an overview of our programs. And then I also included in my slide deck, included in that overview are some of the challenges and opportunities that we see at DHS on the horizon moving forward for the state of Minnesota. So by the end of this presentation, particularly for those of you who are new members, it's my hope that you'll leave with a general understanding of the work of the department and human services. If you have further questions about just the overview nature or anything else about our agency and the work that we do, our legislative staff are available and always willing to have you reach out with specific questions. So much of the human services system in Minnesota and every state is directed by the federal government, and it includes the United States Department of Health and Human Services for our health care and economic assistance programs, and also the U.S. Department of Agriculture for our SNAP nutrition program. And all work, of course, then also depends on the work of the Minnesota State Legislature. Minnesota is one of only 11 states that has a state-supervised, county-administered human services system. And, you know, I think the biggest advantage of that is it moves many decisions and operations to the local level, the closest unit of government to the people being served. Some of the challenges are just, as a function of that, we have many, many different human services agencies all across the state, and it makes consistency in delivery of services a challenge in certain circumstances. And then additionally, Minnesota has 11 tribal governments, and each one of those 11 has a different level of involvement in delivering human services for tribal members. We also have a nonprofit network that we're really proud of in the state of Minnesota that helps deliver human services for the people in the state, including large organizations that the department makes grants to, like Lutheran Social Services and Catholic Charities, as well as smaller community-based organizations that oftentimes are under contract directly with particular counties for certain human services functions. We purchase much of our health care, our medical assistance, and Minnesota care services for public and program enrollees by contracting directly with health plans, which are nonprofit entities in Minnesota. And we also work with for-profit providers. Examples are group homes and nursing homes. So together with the support of this body and the executive branch and the people of Minnesota, our human services system is very strong by many of the metrics that human services systems across the country are measured by. In 2015, the scorecard on state health system performance by the Commonwealth Fund ranked us number one in overall health system, number one in home and community-based services by a 2014 state scorecard on long-term care services and supports by Commonwealth and AARP, number one for overall child well-being by the 2016 National Kids Count data book by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and then the last two by the United Health Foundation 2016 America's Health Rankings ranked us the fourth healthiest state for seniors and the fourth healthiest state. So our mission at the Department of Human Services informs our work on a daily basis and something that we really orient around as an agency when we're performing both the direct care services and the supervisory services for our state human services system. The organizational chart, this is kind of a wonky slide. It just shows the leadership of our agency. I'm the commissioner. We have one deputy commissioner, Chuck Johnson, who's here today. He oversees all the program areas and budget for the Department of Human Services. We also have a chief of staff, Lucelle Stevens, who oversees many of the agency-wide functions with the exception of budget, including the Office of the Inspector General, legal and compliance, human resources, as well as equity. So who we are, we are really fortunate to be an agency full of employees that are dedicated to our mission. These employees in this picture actually are participants in one of our internal leadership development programs that we have at DHS. We broke down on this slide the number of employees by administration, we call them, which is really the different divisions. And then also not included in this number is the over 500 Minnesota IT employees that provide IT services to the department on a daily basis, many of whom are officed in our offices. So this slide shows the full funding breakdown for the Department of Human Services. We have the largest share of the state budget of any agency. The Medical Assistance Program, MA, is by far the largest portion of our funding and the largest program we run, and it accounts for about 74% of all of DHS's spending. In our budget, the MA program falls in the forecasted programs category shown on the slide. On a budget of approximately $16.2 billion for fiscal year 2016, approximately 3% of that funding went to pay for administrative and policy staff in the department. And these staff administer the other 97% of the programs and services that the department is in charge of serving people with. The department's maintained actually this ratio, as you can see on this slide, even as the department's taken on new responsibilities. Some of that work includes compliance with a federal court settlement, the Jensen settlement, nursing facility payment reform, and home and child protection oversight responsibilities that have been growing in the last several years. Dave Greenman, our DHS budget director, will share more details about our financials in the second half of this presentation. I would say, as a note to this, that the 3% does not include direct care and treatment staff or pass-through funds such as Title IV-E funds and child support recovery funds, as well as federal SNAP payments, food assistance payments. So a snapshot of who we serve collectively at the Department of Human Services. Our work, either directly or indirectly, touches the lives of almost every Minnesotan at one point in their lives, from the very young who attend child care programs we license to the very old who call Senior Linkage Line for help and care in nursing homes that medical assistance and other funding sources pay for. More than 420,000 children under the age of 21 receive publicly funded health care through DHS. Child protection is a core part of our mission and one that the legislature is invested in. Every year, 25,000 children are assessed for abuse and neglect in our state. DHS also supports around 32,750 families in poverty with economic assistance, as well as child care assistance for about 29,000 children every month. For seniors, DHS pays for health care for about 63,900 seniors. Increasingly, these services are provided in community-based settings rather than institutions, and we also provide resources for all older adults, including regardless of income. I think people think of DHS as an income qualifying entity, but really with regard to seniors, we provide services across all categories of income, or, you know, without regard to income, And I think the Minnesota Adult Abuse Reporting and Adult Vulnerable Abuse and Neglect Hotline is a good example of that, just as child protection is a good example of that. We also serve people with disabilities. DHS really is striving through our policy and state reform to help people with disabilities live as independently as possible. And we serve over 117,000 people with disabilities in our state every year, helping them with health care and employment, training, and housing so that they can be supported as they lead productive and enriching lives. So the next two slides are some examples of the number of people that DHS serves every year, and more program-specific enrollment, I think, is laid out in a handout that you all should have received, just identifying some specific programs that we run and to give you some context about how many people are being served out of those programs. Medicaid, by far, as I said, it's not only the largest part of our budget, but it's also the highest number of people we serve every year. Did you not get a sheet?
No, I think I should have had a I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As we're looking at the numbers here, I'm seeing a divide amongst the programs, and I know this may not be a state program, but I'm curious as I see the high numbers of Medicaid. What are the numbers, if you know them, for those that are Medicare on a monthly basis?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. We could follow up. I'm sure we can track down some information, but I don't have that with me, but we're happy to follow up.
All right. Thank you.
So the next slide is just a continuation. Children in out-of-home care, our child care average monthly families being served, which amounts to about 29,000 to 30,000 children, how many licensed family child cares there are in the state, and then DHS licensed providers. We conduct background studies for many different types of entities, and it amounts to about 327,000 background studies every year. And then there's about 860, 870 children right now under state public guardianship.
Representative Bloom. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. See, on the background studies, so a daycare or a healthcare provider hires a new employee, and they do the background check. What is the timeline for getting that completed? I've actually been contacted several times in my district by employers that ended up losing an employee because they couldn't get the background check in time, and the people needed the paycheck, and so they went and got a job somewhere else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we know that that's an issue. We process them as fast as we can. We had some challenges in switching systems that we've been trying to manage, but we know that there have been backlogs, and particularly as the economy gets tighter and employers are competing for the same workforce, we know it's been a problem. So I've heard that feedback too. I'm happy to, if you have particular constituents that are dealing with this right now, bring that to our Office of Inspector General where that gets housed so that we can address if it's a systemic concern with a particular type of provider, that'd be really helpful for me to know.
Representative Lewin. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But what's the actual timeline right now then? And what was it when everything was clicking?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it depends on the type of background study and whether or not there are complications relating to it. I think that one of the challenges we have is that there's certain things that happen in a background study, certain checks that are made that can complicate a person's ultimate passage of a background check, and sometimes that can delay things. I don't know, and I'm not sure if Chuck Johnson knows what the before the transition to the new system occurred, how long it, like, on average took. But we can get some of that information to you as best we can. I know that there are people that have worked in the background studies division for a long time that might have that historical context that I just don't have.
Okay, I would appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Fisher. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can give a little anecdotal. The agency I work with, we go through the background check quite a bit. It's much quicker than it used to be. What I've seen is that
For those that are getting fingerprinted, as soon as they get fingerprinted, sometimes within an hour or so. So we've had people that we've been able to turn around in 3 or 4 hours versus what it used to take, you know, 7 to 10 days sometimes. Where I have seen the issues has been what the commissioner has been alluding to, is besides doing the background check by the state, we also check other sources. And where we've seen it taking longer is where there's some question, are these other things that we find out there that causes a hang-up? And that's usually what we find a high tie-out. It's not all the time. But I will say what we've been seeing, from my experience, what I've been seeing, it's much improved. There are still a couple times where it does take, you know, sometimes 4 to 6 weeks, where there are still some that hang up like that. But the vast majority move much quicker. We've been able to hire much quicker than we had in the past. So I thank you for the improvements you've made so far.
Thank you. So now I am going to move into each administration. So each administration is organized with an assistant commissioner that directly oversees that administration's work. So our largest by volume is our healthcare administration. A huge part of what we do, 74% of our budget, goes towards Minnesota's publicly funded healthcare programs. MinnesotaCare and Medical Assistance are the two largest. And earlier this week, I think Sean Welch provided you a closer look at the financials behind MinnesotaCare and Medical Assistance. And I won't go deeply into there except to say that, you know, obviously healthcare, again, is the largest portion of our budget. Approximately 1 in 5 Minnesotans and 1 in 3 children in our state rely on medical assistance or MinnesotaCare for access to healthcare. These programs provide healthcare insurance, really the safety net for low-income Minnesotans, families, elderly, and the disabled in our state, and very low-income adults without children. Medical assistance, Minnesota's Medicaid program, which provides benefit to children, families, seniors with low income, and the people with disabilities, cover generally individuals who earn up to 133% of the federal poverty level, which is about $15,000 annually for a single adult, and then higher incomes for pregnant women and children. In 2016, more than 1 million Minnesotans received health care through medical assistance each month. MinnesotaCare started in 1992 with bipartisan support to provide health coverage to people who struggle to afford insurance but who don't qualify for Medicaid. Sometimes people refer to the people on MinnesotaCare as what people think about as the Minnesota's working poor. Today, people who earn between 138% and 200% of the federal poverty level, roughly $16,000 to $23,500 for a single adult, are covered through MinnesotaCare, and they pay a sliding fee premium anywhere from $0 to $80. And then in 2016, an average monthly average of 115,000 Minnesotans were afforded health care through our MinnesotaCare health care program each month. So where there are some opportunities and challenges that I just want to flag, first, opportunities. Integrated health partnerships in the state of Minnesota have been, I think, a great success and continue to grow. So as part of Minnesota's commitment to deliver high-quality health care more efficiently, in 2013, the Department of Human Services started advancing this new payment model, which prioritized quality preventative care and rewards providers directly for reducing the cost of care for enrollees in medical assistance and MinnesotaCare. Integrated health partnerships have been growing throughout the last several years. There's now 19 healthcare provider groups that are participating, and more than 340,000 enrollees in integrated health partnerships. And the initiative has resulted in over $150 million in lower than expected healthcare expenditures over the 3 years from providers across the state. We've reduced the uninsured rate to 4.5%, and we have the fifth lowest uninsurance rate in the country last year. which is a really significant reduction in what historically had been the case. That really amounts to about 245,000 Minnesotans still in this state that have no private or public health insurance benefits each calendar year. We are getting better value through our purchasing strategies, which is another really significant accomplishment. In 2016, we reached all 87 counties with competitive bidding through our managed care contracts, and we were able to, through that process, undertake major plan shifts, resulting in over 415,000 enrollees having to change plans without a significant disruption in coverage for those enrollees. We also estimate that the competitive bid savings amounts to approximately $445 million in savings over what was projected to be the cost of our contracts through this time. We have a challenge, I think, going forward with carrying forward our legacy of bipartisan innovation. We have real challenges around working together to manage some of the issues, including a projected $2 billion loss of federal funding with a repeal without replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And we also have the challenge of our provider tax sunsetting on December 31st, 2019, which is a source of funding for both Minnesota Care and medical assistance in our state. Our children and families area administers and provides administrative support to counties, tribes, and social services agencies for programs that provide child safety and child well-being services and economic assistance for low-income families and children across the state. So these services really are designed to help ensure that people who receive support, that they receive the support that they need, keeping them healthy and stable in their families and communities. And the programs seek to keep more people fed and healthy by increasing nutrition assistance for people, keeping more children out of foster care and safely with their families, decreasing the disproportionate number of children of color who are in out-of-home placements, and increasing access across the state, particularly in greater Minnesota, to high-quality child care. Our economic assistance and supports includes MFIP, our Minnesota Family Investment Program, which provides job counseling and financial assistance to help stabilize more than 67,000 children and more than 34,000 families in poverty every month. And we have food support, which helps more than 450,000 Minnesotans receive food support in the Minnesota for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program every month. We have our Child Safety and Permanency Area, which works with counties and tribes to prevent child maltreatment, or in certain cases works with courts and law enforcement to remove children from a home if they're in harm's way. And then we also work together with the counties and tribes to safely reunite families, children, and parents when possible, and find adoptive placements for kids under public guardianship. We have our child support area, which services and helps support families by establishing paternity and establishing, modifying, and enforcing child support court orders, and then collecting and processing payment to help support families. And then we have our Child Care Assistance Program, which provides subsidies to about 15,000 families, low-income families, between 29,000 and 30,000 children every month to help improve outcomes for the most at-risk children and their families by increasing access for those children and their parents to high-quality child care. So some opportunities that the state has advanced are creating uniformity among Minnesota's economic assistance programs. Previously and historically, economic assistance programs had four different asset tests that varied different by different programs and had three different earned income disregards. And so each program required a whole bunch of different kinds of checks and financial checks and qualifications to determine someone's eligibility. And then legislation approved in the 2014 session, effective June 2016, provides significant efficiencies, not just for DHS, but for the counties, and created a single asset asset limit of $10,000. It counted assets the same across all the programs. It instituted a single earned income disregard that encourages employment, and it used simplified methodology for determining self-employment income. And then also established common policies for verification and documentation. So that resulted in more consistent and clear policy and policy guidance, and it really eliminated or helped reduce duplicative and conflicting statutes amongst the programs. Child support reforms. Child support payments are now accepted online. As of November 2016, more than 2,400 non-custodial parents have made payments totaling more than $3.4 million with the tool. This is supported by legislation in 2015 to create a new child support we also created a new child support task force through supported legislation and passed legislation in 2015 allowing medical-only child support modifications, and then also passed legislation in 2015 increasing the MFIP child support disregard. We have leveraged effectively federal funding for our Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP it's called. We've worked with DEED and the Office of Higher Education, counties and tribes, and community organizations to expand our SNAP employment and training program. And federal funds are being matched at 50% using existing state expenditures to do this work. And the additional federal funds are estimated at about $4 million a year. They'll be used to help provide employment support for adults who receive SNAP benefits. And then some of the challenges that we have going forward, I think, in children and families, really the two most significant are child protection funding. So those returning members, I'm sure recall, there's $26 million more allocated in child protection funds in 2015, and $1.5 million goes to grants to address disparities and out-of-home placements in the child welfare system. But there's work left to do, and the number of maltreatment reports received through the first three quarters of each year has increased 33% from 2012 to 2016. And the number of accepted maltreatment reports through the first three quarters each year has increased by 72% from 2012 to 2016. The other big challenge we have as a state is child care reauthorization. So we have our child care assistance program is administered through a block grant by the federal government, and we are out of compliance with the requirements of that federal block grant. And we have sought and have an approved waiver to the requirements of the federal block grant that will expire at the end of September this year. And if no changes are made to Minnesota law to conform with the requirements of the federal block grant, we run the risk of losing federal funds. And fiscal penalties to our block grant for noncompliance are about $1.5 to $1.8 million, but the penalties are ultimately at the discretion of the Secretary of Human Services at the federal level, and so it could be more or less than that, and we just don't know.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you talked about child protection funding, did you hear that was 72% increase since 2012?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lunan. It's a 72% increase in the number of accepted child maltreatment reports from 2012 to 2016. So the number of people reporting child protection, child abuse, and the number of those reports that are taken in and accepted, screened in, has increased by 72% since 2012.
Representative Lumen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Why?
Mr. Pike.
That's profound.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Loon. You know, I think there's a lot of different reasons. The state has and the counties have had in the last several years a real spotlight shown on child protection. There was a really terrible case of a child that was killed by his stepmother that resulted in many of the reforms that the governor has advanced and that the legislature has advanced in recent years. Also, I think there's been a challenge historically that counties have really struggled with having the necessary staff to do the child protection work that they do on the local level. And I think that that's part of what has happened, that that work has caught up on counties across the state.
Representative Lund.
Thank you, Chairman. I look forward to Representative Pinto weighing in on this. But the reports that are, so these are received reports, has there been a decline in the percentage of them that have been found to be true, or is that percentage held steady? Or every one of them, when there's smoke, there's fire?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lund, I think that we've seen an increase in a really significant increase in the number of out-of-home placements following child protection reports also through the last several years, which I think is a good measure of more kids are being reported as suffering abuse and more kids are being removed from their home at the hand, you know, because there's a cause to think that that maltreatment actually happened.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, yeah, just a comment for Representative Lunan. I guess I want to hear what the commissioner thinks. My understanding is that Minnesota had one of the lowest rates of child protection cases that were screened in previously in the country. So in terms of percentages, I don't know that the number of cases reported has gone up so much as that historically Minnesota had a very low rate of cases that got screened in and got reviewed and investigated. Instead, it was kind of an alternative track for families. And so the concern was that that alternative track was being used too much. So there's been a big jump as Minnesota's kind of more caught up with the rest of the country in terms of the percentage of cases that actually get investigated. But obviously love to hear what the commissioner has to say.
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we've actually seen both. So we've seen an increase of reports of 33%, and we've seen an increase of 72% in cause, so accepted reports. So we've seen both, but the number of cases screened in has grown as well as the state shifts and puts some more guidelines around those cases that are most appropriate for the family assessment track versus the investigative track.
Okay, thank you.
I think, and members will remember last year, those members that were here, in last term, we had a significant increase in funding for child protection, and Representative Cresha had a child protection committee and task force that they looked at, coming back with specific recommendations along with those dollars. And one of the things that we're, of course, very interested in is how those dollars are being deployed into the counties to have more outreach. Obviously, the tragic case of Eric Dean and others like him across the state pushed folks in that direction. Fortunately, there's very likely not an increase of 72% in child abuse, that there is more oversight. Fewer kids are going to fall between the cracks, but we want to make sure that those dollars are spent as best as we possibly can, and also that people are being added at the caseworker level rather than at the middle level so that folks can get out into the homes and catch that ahead of time. So look for that and for the recommendations to be coming back and also further input that we're going to be soliciting from members in the upcoming year. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for your testimony, Commissioner. Yeah, just a follow-up. Did we change the definition of abuse in any way that contributed to the higher percentages?
I do not believe that we did, Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Greenhagen, I don't think that the definition of abuse has changed.
Okay. All right. Please continue.
Thank you. You know, before I move on from this page, I also would just like to mention not only has the state made really significant investments in child protection, but also that's prompted counties across the state to really step up their investment in child protection as well. So next is our direct care and treatment area, and I know that you held hearings, Mr. Chair, on direct care and treatment last year, but just as a refresher for those who are new to the committee. So of the 6,100 employees that DHS has, 4,200 of them around work in our direct care and treatment area. While the vast majority of mental health services are provided in the community and by hospitals and clinics, the people that the state, that DHS serves, are higher level of care than what's available elsewhere in the community. So we have about 12,000 people we serve every year in our direct care and treatment area. About 4,000 employees provide these services at over 200 sites all across the state. Our major program areas are MSATs, our mental health and substance abuse services, and this includes our community behavioral health hospitals. We have six of them all across the state. They provide short-term inpatient psychiatric care, and they're located in Alexandria, Annandale, Baxter, Bemidji, Fergus Falls, and Rochester. We have our children and adolescent behavioral health hospital in Wilmer, which provides inpatient psychiatric hospital services in a safe setting for kids who need crisis stabilization, comprehensive assessment, and intensive treatment for mental health challenges that they face. We have our Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center, AMRTC, and Anoka provides a hospital level of care in a campus-based setting for adults with a mental illness, and many of the patients have really complex medical histories. We have our CARE programs, our chemical addiction recovery enterprises, and they provide both inpatient and outpatient CD and substance abuse services statewide. CARE programs are located in Anoka and Brainerd, Fergus Falls, St. Peter, Wilmer, and Carlton is a women's only program. And then we have our community-based services, which includes MSOCs, our Minnesota state-operated community services. And that MSOCs provides residential and vocational support services all across the state for people with disabilities. The vocational services include DT&H, day treatment and habilitation services, as well as evaluation training and employment support. And MSOCs has evolved over the years in who lives in the homes. Originally, when these MSOCs homes were created, they were a result of the regional treatments, people being moved out of the regional treatment centers in our state into more of a four-person group home model. And so many of the people that have lived in these MSOCs homes have lived there for many, many years with the same people. Then we have forensic services, which includes the security hospital and our competency restoration program. Our security hospital is located in St. Peter and provides specialized forensic services, including nursing services, for people mostly who are committed mentally ill and dangerous to the Commissioner of Human Services. Our competency restoration program is a program that we partner with the courts, where courts commit people who need their competency restored to stand trial to the Commissioner of Human Services for that restoration of competency. And then we have our state sex offender program, MSOP, which provides court-ordered treatment for people under civil commitment as sex offenders. And most of the sex offenders, there's 722 sex offenders in our program. Most of them start on our Moose Lake campus, and then as they progress through treatment, there's a second sex offender program location in St. Peter on the same campus as Security Hospital. And there's in St. Peter, there is a piece of the program. The vast majority, the biggest part of the program down there are people that are still inside buildings, inside Razor Ribbon. And then there's a program called Community Preparation Services where people go once the courts transfer them to that program, and they live and receive treatment outside of the Razor Ribbon on the same campus down in St. Peter.
Excuse me, Commissioner. There's a question from Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, I got two. One, the Wilmer facility for children. How many beds are there?
Representative Piper, or Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Considine. I'm not exactly sure the full capacity of the current Children and Adolescent Behavioral Health Hospital footprint. I can get you that information. There's less than five children at any time there right now, in part because the building is not designed in a way that allows us to house many more children there. I don't know what the license capacity is, but there's challenges with the footprint of the existing building, and then there's also has been challenges where we've had to reduce our census because the future of that program was unknown, has been unknown, and there's been an issue where the lease was set to expire in 2017, which made it really hard to recruit and retain employees. So we've had to reduce census there because we haven't had staffing to staff up to higher numbers.
So, Mr. Chair, so roughly five. At this point, I'm hearing from local school districts that are going to Des Moines and Sioux Falls for placement for juveniles because that's the closest places they can find. My other question, Security Hospital, recently there was an issue with forced overtime, and I understood that you got involved. Has that been resolved?
Commissioner Piper?
First, to respond to the CAPS question, I think it's probably closer to three children right now. And oftentimes, the kids that are at the CAPS hospital aren't those that are coming from the level four schools. Usually, those kids end up in residential treatment, and there's a shortage of residential treatment in the state. And then those kids wind up going out of state. Also, community hospitals place children out of state because of a shortage of residential beds, but oftentimes that's the issue. There is a need and a shortage of these really intensive services for these really challenging, really sick kids. But oftentimes that's where you hear the challenges of kids being shipped to North Dakota or to surrounding states. As to the challenges at Security Hospital with overtime and overtime mandates, I'm working with leadership there, including Carol Olson, as well as AFSCME leadership to address and try and find some resolution to the issue that was recently raised. I would say that overtime across direct care and treatment is less than it has been and less than it was last year. And so we have been making improvements and advancements, but I'm hopeful that we can continue to work together with labor to address these concerns. Last year, we asked and brought in the Bureau of Mediation Services to really work with both labor and management down at Security Hospital so that we could partner better together on some of these really challenging issues. And one of them is overtime, and a lot of the overtime relates to the need for increases in staffing. Staff funding at Security Hospital, which unfortunately we've been unable to receive that. So we're working on it, and I'm hopeful for a positive outcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, and thank you for getting involved personally in looking into this. I appreciate that.
And, Commissioner, next week we're going to be doing, I think, 2 days on DC&T, and Mr. Cruz has a PowerPoint presentation that he's already got put together for that, so we're looking forward to that next week. So members can bring their questions and work on those. Please continue.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just some challenges, and you'll hear more about this next week. We have a whole host of advancements that we believe we've made, but we also have a lot of opportunities to improve. We've had progress at both State Security Hospital, which I refer to, and our Anoka Hospital, For the last 5 years, State Security Hospital has been under a conditional license, and that conditional license has been lifted, so we're fully licensed as a facility. And Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center was under immediate jeopardy status when I became commissioner last year. We now are on track. We've hired our experts from CMS and are working really closely with the federal government to get a corrective action plan approved to really start and continue the improved quality over the next 12 months at that hospital with CMS. We have improved access to psychiatric beds, and this is a result of the governor's supplemental budget request and the legislature funding an increase to our capacity at our community behavioral health hospitals, these 16-bed hospitals all across, six of them all across the state. We only had funding for 10 beds to be staffed at any given time, and so there were six beds sitting empty at every one of the hospitals while people were backing up at other hospitals. And so we're pleased. We know that we need ultimately about 200 employees to be up to capacity for all six of those facilities. We had a hiring blitz the first week of November and hired 75 people, and we've been recruiting ever since. And so in addition to that, the governor recommended and the legislature funded a standalone competency restoration program down in St. Peter, not on the big campus, but repurposing a facility that already existed into, it was a chemical dependency, a care facility, into a standalone competency restoration facility, which is set to open, knock on wood, in the next week. So we're very proud of that work. And competency restoration has been one of those really, really challenging areas trying to manage that population. We think that it will take about 20 people out of Anoka at any given time who don't need hospital level of care there and place them in a more appropriate setting down in St. Peter. Additionally, we anticipate it'll take about 12 people out of security hospitals competency restoration program, and when they're ready, have available a step down competency restoration program in a different facility. So we're very excited about that. We have funding challenges, and stabilizing funding has been a really significant issue for the direct care and treatment area. You might recall last year we sought and received $28 million in one-time stabilization funding for these group homes, 120 of them that we operate all across the state of Minnesota. They are on an enterprise fund, meaning the rates we receive for services are supposed to pay for the care for the people, and the rates are not, the rates we're receiving are not keeping up with the cost of caring for these populations of people we're serving. And so that's something that was a one-time stabilization funding measure that we're working on a proposal to provide more stabilized ongoing funding for that population. We've taken significant steps in the last year to stabilize that funding without further action of the legislature, but there are some things that are going to continue to be a challenge with the current funding structure of those group homes. We have, frankly, really been challenged with staffing, recruitment, and retention. Minnesota Security Hospital remains staffed at levels lower than like institutions all across the country. Staff retention is a persistent problem, which is in part due to this being short-staffed perpetuates people looking for other jobs because other jobs are more appealing when you're not mandated to overtime as often. And then also we are having challenges with wages and bonuses and benefits afforded to people in the private market versus what we can pay in certain positions for those most competitive, sought-after professionals. For example, nurses in private hospitals earn between $5 and $7 more an hour than those starting in state government. And additionally, now because they're in such high demand, hospitals and other treatment providers are offering pretty significant hiring incentives for nurses. We also know, for example, a security hospital, We really struggle with our security counselor staffing. We know that Walmart warehouse salaries are higher paid salaries in that same area than our security counselor positions in state government. So we're really working hard, particularly with the nurses, partnering with community colleges and trying to do more outreach for encouraging people to apply for and work in state service. But it continues to be a challenge and just something that we're working on. And then finally, one of the, I would say, the most significant challenge, or one of the most significant challenges we have is community placements for sex offenders in our sex offender program that courts across, courts have discharged, provisionally discharged people to particular locations or otherwise. And, you know, I and my staff are charged with finding placements based on these court orders for people and not having those placements be available. And so historically, the governor has requested funding to build facilities to house sex offenders who are provisionally discharged from our program. And also the legislature, the governor has supported and the legislature has funded in the past expansions to our community preparation services program. And that's the program that I referred to earlier outside of the Razor Ribbon in St. Peter, but on the St. Peter campus, that people are transferred by the courts there prior to a move to provisional discharge. And the legislature's funded in the past through bonding expansions to that program. The last expansion opened this year based on prior year's bonding, and it's already full. And we have three court-ordered transfers inside the Razor Ribbon already backed up and waiting to be transferred to our community preparation services. So that continues to be a challenge. Changing topics completely, we have our community supports administration, which is 269 employees that oversees delivery systems for mental health, people with disabilities, alcohol and drug abuse, people who are deaf, deafblind, and hard of hearing, and people in need of housing supports. And it includes prevention, treatment, long-term services supports, home and community-based services, and grant programs that the agency administers. So we have real opportunities to, we've worked hard over the interim at the direction of the legislature several years ago to engage in a multi-year reform initiative around chemical health. And so the 2017 substance use disorder reform recommendations really started with a legislative mandate, and we've been working all across the state of Minnesota, in particular our alcohol and drug abuse division, in the summer of 2016, traveling the state of Minnesota to engage in efforts to modernize Minnesota's substance use disorder system. And the result is a set of policy recommendations to not only improve outcomes, but also to ensure program sustainability and how to better invest scarce resources wisely. We really focus on increased access to affordable housing choices, which is critical to people with disabilities, mental illness, and also accessible and affordable to people. For people on public health care programs, we need to and are really challenged to give people in more choice in where to live. We have had great improvements in 24/7 access to crisis services across the state. In 2015, Minnesota invested $8.6 million for the next biennium into improved crisis services for both children and adults. And as part of this charge, we'll present some, I think, really significant and strengthened service standards for mobile crisis services provided across the state. We have challenges similar to direct care and treatment in that we have real we struggle with workforce shortages. Minnesota is struggling across many sectors in workforce, and direct care and support is no exception. And we convened a workforce summit in July with many stakeholders to try and come up with and develop some really creative solutions. And I think that, you know, one of the challenges we all face is that there's no silver bullet solution to any of these issues. But we're really fortunate in Minnesota that everyone recognizes the problem, is trying to work forward together with a solution. And then one other challenge for the state of Minnesota is the home and community-based services final rule. And that will greatly impact how we operate our home and community-based services system in our state. And it says the home and community-based services rule really says that people receiving publicly paid long-term services and supports, they have to receive those services in the most integrated setting and have full access to benefits of community living while receiving those services. And the rule requires person-centered planning and requires services provided and offered within communities to people. We have our Continuing Care and Older Adults Administration. It has 121 employees, and it works to support and enhance the quality of life for older people in Minnesota, manage an equitable and sustainable long-term care system that maximizes value, continuously improve how we deliver services to older adults in our state, and promote professional excellence and engagement in the work that we do. We've had real opportunities and successes in our programs. Return to Community is a really good example. It's moved over 4,000 older adults in Minnesota away from stays in nursing homes, and then saving, helping them save and support their money so they don't spend their MA down while in nursing home care. We help provide them services and supports while they're not yet MA eligible to get out of the nursing home and live in their homes for a longer period of time, which saves money because nursing home care is very expensive to the MA budget. We have report cards that measure quality. We have a nursing home report card that measures quality in nursing homes. And we still have gaps or challenges, though, in quality reporting for other facilities, particularly assisted living facilities don't have similar quality reporting functions. We have advanced value-based reimbursement for nursing home facilities, and it's invested millions of dollars in facilities all across the state, and the rates now that are being paid by medical assistants are more closely tied to service quality. The challenges that we have are our shifting demographics. From just 2010 to 2014, Minnesota's 65-plus population grew by more than 97,000 people. And we know that by 2030, the 65-plus population will serve to 1.26 million members. And we know, too, from the state demographer that it's not just a one-time peak, that it will that demographic will continue to sustain through the next many years of projection. So with that comes increased pressure on already challenging service provider functions. We know that many of the people in Minnesota receive their services in the community, and so we see a workforce shortage that only is going to continue to grow as more people seek that workforce. We estimate that there's about 59,000 positions that need to be filled right now in Minnesota, and so as the demographic changes and there's more older people, that gap in positions and people there to provide the services is going to continue to grow. And then finally, we have our policy and operations overview. So we have 553 employees in this area. This area serves external staff or external customers, internal staff, It ensures quality and integrity in our public resources. So this is our licensing staff, licensing providers, and conducting background studies. It's our Office of Inspector General. It's our human resources staff, our financial management staff, our legal services, and all of our facilities management staff. And one of the focuses of the Inspector General and our compliance office and a lot of these support staff is to ensure the prudent use of taxpayer dollars to investigate, prevent, and stop fraudulent uses of state and federal money that DHS is charged with managing. So we have had some taken advantage of some real opportunities. We've expanded our investigations into MA and child care provider fraud. The Office of Inspector General, the OIG, fraud investigations has stopped improper payments, recovered public funds, and removed providers from being able to serve public program recipients. In calendar year 2015, we stopped payments to 121 medical assistance providers and terminated or suspended enrollment in MA for 174 providers. So we also have worked hard on consistent application of county delegated licensing functions. So the legislature has delegated under the Human Services Licensing Act certain responsibilities to counties to perform the human services functions for the people in their counties, like child foster care licensing and family child care licensing. And that functionally and practically means that people and providers interact with their county licensors and not directly with the state on a regular basis. And a common concern for providers is a lack of consistency, or has been a lack of consistency depending on what county you're in. And so many of these issues have been brought to light by legislative task forces working on child care issues. And consistent application of licensing standards and consistent work and engagement with counties and direction in our role as a state supervisor has really, I think, improved how those challenges are being addressed by the state of Minnesota.
Commissioner Piper, Representative Lunan has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the back to the bullet point on fraud, what typically starts the we need to do an investigation process? Is there a typical pattern, or are there all different situations that pop up?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lunan. I think one of the complaints are a big component of how we commence an investigation. It depends on the type of provider. We know that we have challenges in certain areas that aren't, in particular those areas that aren't inspected on a regular basis by DHS, so, or by the county. So we're really challenged in, for example, home and community-based services. It's a very complaint-driven function that we provide. We receive a complaint, we send our investigators in, particularly for maltreatment, send our investigators in, they make a finding of maltreatment, and they cite the provider, or they revoke their license. But there are different ways. You know, I think that there are other ways as well that we try and be more proactive.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But specifically to the fraud, the verification that people are utilizing the services should be, you guys handle that, those verifications yourself, correct?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Specific to medical assistance, do you mean?
Right. Sure.
So we have a process by which we determine people's eligibility. The fraud that we see the most significant is really provider fraud, not individual consumer fraud. And so it's fraud in billing, not fraud in whether or not somebody actually received the services.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The as far as the eligibility for people participating in MA, that utilizes reviewing tax, I'm assuming tax information.
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, we check eligibility on a variety of sources, including tax information. And then we can provide somebody that does the eligibility determinations to talk with you, but in more depth. But once there's we receive the information from the individual, it's checked against the variety of confirmation sources that we utilize, including the federal government. And if there's a discrepancy, then we afford the individual an opportunity then to explain the discrepancy before we make an eligibility determination for that particular person.
Okay, thank you. And I'd be interested in talking to that person.
Great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Representative Lunan. After the legislative auditor's report last year that showed a significant number of Minnesotans who were signed up for programs for which they were not eligible, we did have some bills from Representative Drazkowski and others that looked at trying to tighten up the eligibility and fraud within the program and just leakage within the program. So I'm sure that's something that we will continue to talk about this year.
And one of my points or what I'm looking for on this is we're going to, in an attempt to deal with some of the huge premium, not this committee, but the premium increases, we're looking at to see if there's an effective way we already have to do verification for a income means for premium relief in the individual health market. And I suspect in more than one place we have the mechanisms laying around, and I suspect this department might be one of them, and to see how they're doing it and how well it's what's working, what isn't working, so we aren't reinventing the wheel.
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think one of the challenges, and I know I'm not sure if this has been discussed yet in your committee or elsewhere, one of the challenges is there's very limited purposes for which the tax data that we access can be used, and the IRS controls those regulations. The state of Minnesota doesn't, and so that's something that just is potentially a challenge to accessing that data at the federal level, not at the state level.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Ms. Chair. Commissioner, one of the things that has been discussed in the past here is the need to upgrade county technology on the verification process. I sat down during the office session with my county workers, and I do have to admit I had a lot of empathy for them, switching screens, trying to get reports, and a lot of it is attestation. In other words, just what the person tells you, and then try to do some cross-verification on that with outdated technology and computers. And I think even some of it is DOS, if I remember right, which most of us don't use anymore, hopefully. But is there any plans? They told me there's some type of grant out there that if we provide, this was my understanding, if we provide $10 million of state funding, we can draw down $90 million of a federal match to that, and will that if we can do that, will that specifically be targeted to upgrade this outdated system, which makes the people who do this stuff, which I, God bless them, their lives a lot easier and not quite so miserable. And I was miserable after I walked out of there, to tell you the truth.
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Grunhagen. So we do have the opportunity. We've taken advantage. The legislature has invested funding in our systems modernization effort historically. And you're right, there are certain systems that have really, they currently have 90-10 drawdowns with the federal government. And so we're hopeful that we can, in a bipartisan way, continue to invest in these system modernization efforts going forward. Building on the work that we've done, we're working off of the same 20-plus-year-old IT systems as the counties are oftentimes and struggling with the same challenges as they are. And so there's opportunities across several different human services functions to draw down varying degrees of federal matching, but really significant opportunity in a 90-10 match, as long as the federal government continues to put up that higher match, which is uncertain at this point, but is available now.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, for all you do for the people of Minnesota. Going back to the previous question, can you just clarify for the committee that it's a different population that you're looking at tax verification of income compared to what's happening on the individual market?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz. So the individual market population is really in large part comprised of people that aren't eligible for our public health care program. So it's those folks that are above 200% of the federal poverty line that don't qualify for Medicaid and they don't qualify for Minnesota care. And our use, so DHS's use of that federal tax information is limited to the populations that are on Medicaid and that are on Minnesota care as their basic health plan in the state.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going back to the question just prior, was the dated IT system that we're used in the state, would that be the same system MMB would use if they were required to verify income, tax income, for those on the individual market that qualified?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schultz. I can't answer that question. I can find out from MMB what their plan would be on what system they would use. I think it would be the same access point, but I'm not clear on whether or not it would be our system then.
Okay, thank you.
And to be clear, the counties, if you're seeking subsidies to help you with a private health insurance policy through MNsure and a QHP, that is with the same system of eligibility determination of our public programs, which I would like to separate completely, so hope you'll support me on that. We'll see how that goes. All right. Representative Lunan.
I'll leave that point.
Thanks. All right, Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Dean. The last thing I would just say that is going to be a challenge for us this legislative session is just DHS's operating adjustment to continue running all of the programs and the facilities that we operate, and something that I'm hopeful to work with all of you on. As I said, about 4,200 of our 6,100 employees are in that direct care and treatment area, and they are the employee salaries and compensation are really the fundamental, the biggest piece of the operating adjustment necessary. So with that, I'm happy to answer any further questions that you all have. Dave Greenman, our budget director for DHS, is here also to give a more in-depth financial presentation.
Thank you, Commissioner, for slogging through and for grabbing our somewhat random questions one at a time and interrupting your program. I appreciate you allowing us to do that. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, kind of our random questions. And so here's one I held to the end because it maybe is, one of the things that always strikes me is that we get the presentations about how much we do. We do a lot of our work, our human services work, through nonprofits. You mentioned this. And then we have this pretty large direct care and treatment apparatus under DHS. And so we're doing a lot of our work with people with disabilities and so on through kind of two different related but different systems. And so could you just sort of give us the overview of, why do we have the two systems? How do we sort of, how does somebody end up in one or another of them? Is it that, I think I've heard it talked about before, that, in the direct state system, we've got the more disabled population. And, is that kind of the way it works out? Or is there some other theory? Or is it just historic why we're doing things kind of both ways?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Liebling. I think that the general test applied to the people that we serve in direct care and treatment is that there's no private provider that can treat them. And so it could be a person suffering from acute mental illness that has behaviors that are so severe that a private hospital or a jail, which is the two places where people come to us most to our hospitals, can't manage their behaviors, can't help heal them. And so we provide the safety net backstop for that really sick person who no one else can care for. A foundational piece of that is that they're committed to the Commissioner of Human Services. And so that also is another sort of, I guess, test of people coming into our hospitals and our chemical dependency facilities is that they're civilly committed. But really it is that there isn't another provider there to serve them, and so we step in and provide that service. And that's true for people who are mentally ill and dangerous, who are incompetent to stand trial, who are suffering from acute mental illness in jails, who are in hospitals, children who have really challenging behaviors as a result of their mental illness or their disability, and sex offenders who are civilly committed following their criminal sentence. So I think that's really the test, if you were going to apply one, and the distinction between the services that the state provides and what all these great providers all across the state are doing in partnership.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, this isn't a question. I've been following the problems at the security hospital now for a couple of years, and there has been significant improvement under Commissioner Piper's leadership. She mentioned the bringing in the Bureau of Mediation, opening up lines of communication between the line staff and the supervisors. That's been a real big help. But until we have adequate staffing there, there's not really a lot more they can do. So I think that's something we need to be taking a really careful look at. Latest thing was the forced overtime. Well, if you're getting forced into overtime, you're not going to be staying there for a long time, which then we have more training costs and more recruitment costs. So anyway, thank you so much for your leadership in this area, and I look forward to keep working with you on it.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I met with some local nurses, and they were talking about some concerns that they had around the mental health issue. And they were given examples where a person was with law enforcement, was brought into the hospital in handcuffs. Then law enforcement took the handcuffs off, turned this patient over to nurses who are not necessarily trained to deal with this individual. And then they're housed, if you will, on the same floor as other patients and children. And they're just raising these very, very concerning issues, if you will. Commissioner, I don't know if if any of these examples have been brought forward to you, and what would be the answer? I mean, how do we address that?
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hamilton. This is one of the things that the task force, or the governor convened a task force on mental health, and he had law enforcement on the task force and appointed law enforcement to the task force to have just these conversations and to talk about what potential solutions and recommendations there may be for communities. I would say it's particularly challenging in greater Minnesota, and there are some really unique and promising things that communities are doing. I think a good example is what Blue Earth County is doing around their jail diversion program, where they partner Human Services and the local sheriff's office to assess a person when they come in before they're booked into jail after they've been arrested, to say, what does this person need? Do they need to go into jail, or are they suffering from a mental health crisis? And what are those crisis services that person needs right away? And having that mental health professional there as part of the triage team on the front end. And so I think it's a challenge. It's a struggle. We face it, too, with the number of people that we have coming to Anoka directly from jails, where it's you take off the handcuffs and there's nurses standing there waiting to admit a patient directly from jail. So it's something that we struggle with. I think every community is different, but there are communities that are piloting some really promising ways to try and address it so that it isn't a cold handoff, that it's a warm handoff. I think it's everything from increasing mental health treatment training for law enforcement professionals, so when they arrive on the scene, they have mental health training. And I know that many law enforcement organizations across the state are providing that to their officers. And then I think places like Duluth, they're sending along a mental health professional with law enforcement to scenes where there's a mental health issue, and then that person works with law enforcement and then works with the hospital. They partnered with the health systems up there to help a more warm handoff for those people. But it's not an easy issue, and it seems to be a growing issue across the state, particularly as places like Anoka have been less able to accept patients from hospitals as we accept more patients from jails.
Commissioner, just as a follow-up to that, you talked a little bit about DHS and DOC working together in the community. One of the recommendations last year, I think, from the legislative auditor was to have DHS look at the treatment programs within the prisons to look at how we're doing with mental health and treating folks when they are inside. As you know, there's a great deal of mental illness within the incarcerated population, which then either after release or during treatment within incarceration into the hospitals, there's overlap. Has there been any effort or any movement in that direction?
Well, I think that most of the effort in pockets of the state has been in jail. So the jail population is so not people in prison, but people in county jail where they decompensate and then they get committed to competency restoration or Rule 20'd to me, ordered to one of my facilities. And so there have been local communities that have piloted more community-based services and treatment, partnering between local jails and health systems. I think HCMC and the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office has been working to develop some piloting of more robust mental health services while people are incarcerated. I think one of the challenges, particularly in Minnesota, is that there aren't those mental health professionals available and at the ready to then partner with local sheriff's office because they're just smaller communities.
Representative Zerwas.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, just to kind of follow up on Chair Dean's question, there was a few months back, I think it was the Star Tribune did, I think, a four-article series about isolation and segregation in prisons, and specifically with inmate population suffering from mental illness. I've spoken a little bit with the Department of Corrections, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are as far as kind of the fine line between punishing and isolating individuals, perhaps because of mental illness symptoms expressed during the times of their incarceration, and how isolation might further exacerbate that problem. I think the numbers that the article highlighted showed a not uncommon occurrence of individuals being in isolation upwards to 200 to 300 days out of the year, and then in many instances going straight from hundreds of days of isolation to release to the street with no follow-up services. So I'm wondering if, you know, often the mentally ill population falls into a group of folks that you serve, and when we see them in the correction system, they're treated differently. And I'm just wondering if you have some thoughts on strategies that the legislature could take to approach that.
Commissioner Piper.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Zerwas. We, so at DHS, one of the challenges we had at Security Hospital was the overuse of seclusion and restraints. And that's one of the ways that we wound up with a conditional license 5 years ago on our facility, because we were restraining people and secluding people too much. And, you know, in some ways, we're dealing with a lot of the same people and trying to manage the same population as the correction system is. Our sex offenders, many of them have come from a criminal conviction and a criminal sentence and been civilly committed following into our sex offender program. The people who are mentally ill and dangerous at Security Hospital, they oftentimes have criminal pasts, and the reason why they're there and they're civilly committed as opposed to being in the criminal justice system is not because they didn't commit crimes, but because they weren't, you know, they weren't competent to stand trial for the crimes. And so we really have made an effort in the last 3 years to reduce the seclusion and restraint across all of our programs. But it's not easy. And done with error can result in things like higher injury rates for our employees and other challenges that we have in managing the population. And so I would just, I guess if I was offering advice or encouragement, it's encourage training and effectively training staff in a whole new model of care and model of patient management or person management as you embark on a systems change, if that's what you're intending to do. Because without training, it just creates a crisis, just a different kind of crisis.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I think with the remaining time left, we should probably have Mr. Greenman come down and fly through some of our budget overview slides and perhaps hold questions until the end. But thank you for being so generous with your time, Commissioner. We do appreciate that. And I'm sure as members have additional questions, they will follow up with you and also with requests for additional subject area reviews as they come up throughout the session. So we do appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Mr. Greenman, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for having me today. My name is Dave Greenman. I'm the budget director at the Department of Human Services. And I'm here to give you a financial overview of the department's budget. This will be a high-level overview, and given the amount of time, I think I may skip through some slides, but please feel free to ask any questions. We're happy to do any follow-ups if there are questions that you don't get a chance to ask. I'm happy to follow up in any way. First of all, to give you some context of where the department's budget fits within the overall state budget, as you can see, this is the all-funds state budget for fiscal year 2016-17. As you can see, the department accounts for 43% of the budget. This includes both state and federal funds. The Department of Human Services is about $16 billion total all-state, all funds. In fiscal year 16, or about $33 billion in fiscal year 16-17. DHS gets more federal funds than most other agencies in the state, which is one reason why we make up such a big part of the overall budget when you look at all funds. If you were to look at this pie chart with just general fund spending, we'd be about 29% of the overall budget for the state. So how does the $16 billion break down? As I mentioned previously, the majority of our money is federal. Most of our spending is with federal funds. Other sources of funding include the general fund, healthcare access fund, state special revenue fund, which includes our licensing division and child support divisions. We also have enterprise funds, as the commissioner mentioned earlier, These fund our chemical dependency treatment program through the direct care and treatment activities, and also our Minnesota State Operated Community Services. One thing to note is the other is at the top. What that includes is about $615 million in child support enforcement payments, which are passed through the department to those families receiving the funds. How this works is we collect the child support payments and pass them through to the families. The reason it's part of our budget is because the dollars flow through us. So this slide shows the same for the same $16 billion for fiscal year 16. This shows how it's broken down by program area. As the commissioner mentioned, medical assistance is the vast majority of our spending, 74%. About 3% of our spending is with direct care and treatment, which is where the majority of our FTEs are located, as the commissioner mentioned. Children and families account for about 9% of our budget. The reason they're larger than other program areas is because they have forecasted programs in them, albeit smaller than medical assistance, things like the MFIT program, child care, our North Star program, which is that explains why that's a fairly large slice of the pie relative to the other programs. So overall spending trends, as you can see, spending is growing. The majority of our growth is in federal funds, particularly MA, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. Just to give you some context of how things are growing, as you know, as I'm sure you can imagine, there's a lot of factors that that cause spending to either grow or not grow, and so it's hard to pinpoint one specific area that's causing growth. But just to give you some sort of perspective, from fiscal years 13 and 14, our forecasted programs increased by about $1 billion, which accounts for the majority of the change during that period. That was mainly due to the expansion of the Affordable Care Act for families with kids and adults without children under the MA program. From 14 to 15, the $1.4 billion increase between those 2 years resulted again from forecasted programs, part of which was the growth in our long-term care and home and community-based services area, as well as some continued growth from the implementation of the ACA. And finally, from 15 to 16, where growth was about $600 million in forecasted programs. Again, this was partially due to a nursing facility rate increase that went into effect in January of 2016. So now that we've looked at spending, I wanted to just briefly touch on a sense of where our funding comes from. As we mentioned, that direct appropriations account for about $6.35 billion of our spending in fiscal year 16, which is about 41% of overall spending for the department. Direct appropriations include our general fund, our healthcare access fund, TANF, and the state government special revenue fund. Later this year, you'll all be setting our biannual budgets for those direct appropriated programs for the fiscal year 18-19 biennium. Federal funding is about $8.4 billion, and that's about 54% of our overall funding sources. And then other statutory funding is about $793 million, or about 5%. As a proportion of DHS spending, federal dollars increased from about 50% to 54% since state fiscal year 2014, which is about $2.5 billion. Next, I'll talk briefly about FTEs at the department. As the commissioner mentioned, we have FTEs in our policy areas that are charged with implementing our programs. The majority of our FTEs are in direct care and treatment. Above is a breakdown of the FTEs by fund. The majority of our FTEs are in the general fund and in our enterprise funds, which is where direct care and treatment is housed. We also have FTEs in healthcare access funds and in the federal funds. We receive federal grants. We sometimes are able to hire staff with the federal grants that we receive. And we also receive special revenue funds that higher FTEs, particularly in the areas of licensing and background studies and child support. Real briefly, this slide shows this basically is what the commissioner went through earlier today. About over two-thirds of our FTEs are in direct care and treatments, with smaller numbers going into the other program areas. This shows our trend in FTEs over time, this next slide. The reason for the reduction from fiscal years 15 to 16, there's two main factors. One is the consolidation of IT services. Previously, IT services were provided by DHS staff. However, there was a shift in fiscal year 16 with the IT consolidation, about 500 FTEs shifted from DHS to the new Minute department. So we've now purchased IT services as a service rather than through our payroll expenditures. Then the other factor for the reduction is a temporary hiring freeze that the department imposed upon itself due to a shortfall in one of our enterprise programs during fiscal year 2016. One thing to note that we do expect FTEs to increase again in fiscal year 17. One of the reasons why is that there was a significant increase of about 400 FTEs in our direct care and treatment area as a result of some funding provided by the legislature in 2016, as the commissioner mentioned earlier. So now I thought I'd talk a little bit about the direct care and treatment area. The commissioner already covered a lot of this, so I'll go through it very quickly. The overall budget for direct care and treatment is about $416 million in fiscal year 16. It's spread among a number of different program areas within the department. Mental health and substance abuse includes the Anoka Regional Treatment Center, our community behavioral health hospital, our child and adolescent behavioral health services, and our intensive regional treatment centers. Our forensic services, which account for about $82 million, include our security hospital, as well as the competency restoration program. The sex offender program accounts for about $83 million in fiscal year 16, and that includes both the Moose Lake and the St. Peter campuses. And finally, community-based services accounts for about $115 million, which is our largest single area of spending. This includes our Minnesota community-operated, state-operated community services programs, as well as our community addiction recovery enterprise program. This slide shows real briefly the FTEs by program area within the direct care and treatment area. More FTEs are in the community-based services program, which is where our MSOC program is. MSOC serves about 400 vulnerable Minnesotans in over 120 homes throughout the state, and those staffs serve the folks in those homes. I'll talk briefly about forecasted programs. Previously, I showed the slide that showed that MA accounts for about 74% of the department's budget. On this slide, you can see that MA is actually a number of different programs serving a number of different population groups. 34% of our spending is on long-term care and home and community-based services, with another 18% for elderly and disabled. 37% is for families with children and adults without children, basic care. This is basically the expansion population under the ACA. And the rest include our smaller, relatively smaller, forecasted programs, including child care, MFIP, alternative care, and North Star. Move on from there. One slide worth noting, this slide shows our medical assistance actual spending and monthly enrollment broken out by major eligibility group between elderly and disabled, children and families, and adults without kids. What this slide shows is that about 58% of our overall MA expenditures are for about 17% of the MA population, which is the elderly and disabled. And about 60% of the $6.3 billion we spent in fiscal year 16 for elderly and disabled were for long-term care services. and we expect this to continue to grow over time as more folks, as the baby boom population continues to age. The two groups most impacted by the ACA are families with kids and adults without children. Combined enrollment in MA for those populations is about 900,000. Since January of 2014, enrollment among those groups has increased by about 300,000 in the MA program.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quickly, could you just repeat the percentages you gave us about, you know, what percentage are of the people and what percentage of the money? It went by a little fast.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, about 50% of MA expenditures, the slice, the $6.3 billion slice, is directed towards the population of elderly and disabled on the medical assistance program, and that's about 17% of the overall enrollment. Thank you. This next slide shows forecast trends for long-term care spending. Long-term care includes both home and community-based services and institutional care. The overall growth in spending in this area represents a shift from institutional care to home and community-based services. As you can see, the dark blue line remains fairly flat while the green line continues to go up. In home and community-based services, the growth in spending is attributable to about 60% is the increase in recipients or enrollment increases, and about 40% is to the average cost of care. So that's how those, that explains how those amounts are going up. Overall, institutional care is about 85% nursing home and about 15% intermediate care facilities. Home and community-based service payments from fiscal year 16 to 21, the annual growth is projected at about 8% per year for that group. Next, we have a slide showing the forecast trends for the base medical assistance basic care program. As you can see, and I don't know if you can read that little piece on the slide, but as you can see, there's overall growth in spending, although it sort of fluctuates from every other year. And I can explain that if that'd be helpful. But elderly and disabled basic care growth is attributable to about 50% enrollment and 50% to the cost of care for that population, whereas families with kids and adults without kids, the growth in spending is mainly due to the result of the enrollment growth under the Affordable Care Act. You can see if you look at in fiscal year 11, you can see that tiny sliver at the top, which is the adults without kids population. We started enrolling those folks in March of 2011 at the end of the fiscal year. That's when that population started to enroll. The ACA was fully implemented in January of 14, which explains the growth in fiscal years 14 and 15 on as you can see from the green and light blue bars, I'll skip that. From fiscal year 2019 to 2021, we expect expenditures to grow by about 6.5% per year in our basic health care programs.
Mr. Greenman, I apologize. We're going to have to wrap it up because we have to get to caucus on the floor. If you want to just conclude with the overall trend slides and maybe some wrap-up, we should probably be wheels up in about 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The rest of the slides go through Minnesota Care expenditures. I believe Mr. Welch already provided some information about the trends here. We'd be happy to follow up, though, if there are more questions. And then the last slide is our non-MA forecast trends. As you can see, there's a number of small programs, forecasted programs, the growth in this area really results from making the North Star program a forecasted program, which happened in fiscal year 16. So in conclusion, just to leave you with our spending on central office is small. The majority of our spending is in programs and services. Direct care and treatment has over 66% of our FTEs, and they serve over 12,000 people. And the forecast for medical assistance is driving the majority of our spending in the state.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Greenman. Representative Loeffler, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say I appreciate the information on the forecasted programs, which get to grow based on need and population changes. But the significant part of your budget is also non-forecasted, which means waiting lists for a variety of services. And since you weren't able to cover that, if you could get us some information, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, I can Representative Loeffler, we can do that.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll be following up, Mr. Greenman. And I apologize for making you squeeze in your presentation. That was my fault, not yours. So I apologize to you for making you speed through that a little bit too quickly. But I'm sure we'll be following up with lots more. And with that, I say thanks, and we are adjourned.